that was one thing. If Fred couldn't be here today, and he said that you had the opportunity to, you know, he said we'll take Fred and we'll go feed him to the sharks.
Yeah, we'll just chum with Fred.
Yeah.
They love ascots. Sharks.
This is episode 191 of Bourbon Pursuit. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny. Now let's run through a little bit of the news. The Fraser Museum. It's the first stop on the Kentucky Bourbon Trail, located in the heart of downtown Louisville. But the news this week is that they are now selling Prohibition-era dusty bottles. In 2017, House Bill 100 passed that allowed retailers in bars in Kentucky to sell vintage whiskey, and it's good to see others now taking advantage of this new law. The Fraser does an incredible job of sharing the history of these distilleries, of where these bottles originated, because they were all lost during Prohibition. You can find out more at frasermuseum.org. Barton 1792 is going to be in need of more repairs. On Tuesday, 60,000 gallons of mash spilled across the premises and covered the parking lots. Their beer wells experienced a failure. If you're unfamiliar, a beer well holds fermented mash before it is distilled. One tank failed, another tank was punctured, and a pipe on a third tank was damaged, causing the tanks to leak. According to news sources, two employees have been injured in the incident. Ryan and I will be presenting at the Louisville Bourbon Society on March 18th. Come, we want to see you there in person, learn more about the podcast, and get a chance to try some of our private label Pursuit series. Your first attendance is free, and you can bring a friend. Get more information at thebourbonsociety.org. Trey Zoller made his first appearance on Bourbon Pursuit back on episode 63. We talked about the brand and how it began, his original voyage of Jefferson's Ocean, that long-lost rye, and the epic Stitzel-Weller barrels. On this episode, he makes his return, but we're also joined by his father, Chet. We go back even further in time, before the brand was ever established, to talk about how he sourced whiskey, and if he's starting to feel the money squeeze, as today, sourcing is becoming harder because distilleries want to start hanging on to their current stocks. Are you looking a way to support the show without joining Patreon? Spread the good word. Give us an iTunes review and share the podcast with a friend. Up next, we've got Joe from Barrel Bourbon, and then you've got Fred Minnick with Above the Char.
Hi, Joe from Barrel Bourbon here. Every release is intentionally unique and can't be duplicated. Once it's gone, it's gone. Use our store locator to find a retailer or bar near you at barrelbourbon.com.
I'm Fred Minnick, and this is Above the Char. As I walked into Doc Crow's, I was mesmerized, absolutely tickled with about to eat a big old rack of ribs. I was happy I had great company with me, and I was excited to talk to people I didn't know. I love talking to people about bourbon. I can't talk about it enough, even though that's how I make my living. It's also how I have fun. I love bourbon. What can I say? And at the bar were five people who were celebrating a friend's birthday. I walked up to them, started talking, and we kind of all hit it off. Some of them were in healthcare, some of them were in administrative work, and we just chatted. And it kind of reminded me of like what I love about Louisville is that no matter where you are, you can always talk to somebody and you can find a couple people you may have in common. And I was in a moment. I was very happy, and I wanted to buy everyone a round of bourbon. So I looked at the shelf, and as I often do, my eyes spied something that I had liked in the past. It was a bottle of 2012 Old Forester birthday bourbon. Without looking at the menu, without asking the bartender for a price, I said, four of those, please. And I made sure they were in Glencairn glasses, so I did specify the glassware. As the whiskey hit my lips and I felt the complexities of it, I began to wonder, how much is this? And then we just started talking and having a good time, and I forgot all about it. And then the bartender comes up with a white piece of paper. He pushes it toward me. I flip it over. It was more than $500. After tip, the total bill was $600. And I couldn't believe it. After all these years of buying bourbon, I didn't even think to look at the menu. I guess sometimes we all get caught up in the moment, and that was a wonderful time, and those were great people. But is it ever worth it to buy total strangers $600 worth of bourbon? You damn right it is. And you know what? I'll probably do it again one day. So hit me up and let me know when your birthday is, and maybe I'll just come out and buy you something nice. Most likely, Evan Williams bottled and bond, because the bank account's a little hurting right now after that $600 hit. And that's this week's Above the Char. Hey, if you've got an idea for Above the Char, hit me up on Twitter or Instagram. Search Fred Minnick. That's Fred Minnick. Until next week, cheers.
Welcome back to an episode of Bourbon Pursuit, the official podcast of bourbon. Kenny and Ryan on site here in Louisville at a founder's house.
Yep.
Co-founders we're sitting with today. But this is a guest that we'd had on the past, and it's always fun to have Trey on from Jefferson's because he talks a lot about the business. Remember last time, one of the nuggets that I took away was when they were actually starting up the Kentucky Artisan Craft Distillery, and he was talking about how it's actually so much more expensive it is to distill than it is to just buy your own and blend it and bottle it at that point. That was one of my takeaways.
Yeah, I'm sure that, as we know, sourcing, economies of scale and everything, people can make it a lot cheaper than you can yourselves. But I know I keep kicking myself in the head because I forget Trey lives so close to me. And like last time, I think I said I was going to pop in like Kramer, you know, and hang out and drink, but I never have. But now, watch out, I'm coming.
Look, you know the address.
That's right. Well, yeah, it's in my database. You're exactly. One of my customers, so. It's funny, I got here and, you know, Trey's like, well, come look at my back lawn. And I'm like, all right, double dipping, get a podcast and some lawn care out of it.
Yeah, I know. We're making money on all facets.
Yeah, for sure.
So with that, let's go ahead and introduce our guests. So today we have Trey and his father, Chet Zoller. These men are the co-founders of Jefferson's Bourbon. So welcome to the show, fellas.
Thanks a lot for having us.
So Trey, we've had you on before, so I kind of want to talk to Chet just a little bit first here. And kind of talk about growing up around bourbon, or how did you really get into it? Because I don't think I know all of your story.
Well, grew up in the south end of Louisville, and like most good Louisvillians, I learned to drink my bourbon and a Coke at a football game on Saturday. But I did have an uncle who had a brand called Old Brownsboro. And so I was familiar with the business in that regard. But I practiced law, got out of law, and got into telecommunications. I sold my company and thought I had retired. And then Trey came over one day, and he was in sales, didn't like particularly what he was doing, and said, let's do something. So we explored some ideas, and we're here in Kentucky, and what better thing could you do than get in the bourbon business?
Now, yep. Were you a bourbon fan, or were you just kind of like, yeah, well, sure, we'll go ahead and do it?
Well, I've drank bourbon all my life, so sure, I was a fan. My favorite bourbon as a youth was Old Fitz, and turned out to be an excellent choice. So I grew up kind of in the shadow of Churchill Downs, and then very, very close to all the distilleries on 7th and 18th Street. So I could smell that heavenly smell when the wind was right from the distilling that was going on. So bourbon had always been part of my life, and it just seemed a natural thing to do. In 1997, bourbon wasn't very popular. I don't know if you remember, but they almost couldn't give bourbon away. And so we discovered there was a lot of old bourbon available, excellent old bourbon. So Trey and I set about, went across the state sampling bourbons and found one we liked, and decided to get in the business.
Mm-hmm. So what made you think, like you said, bourbon was unpopular, and like, this is it, like, this is going to work? Or did Trey have to convince you that this was going to work?
It's like getting into like the newspaper business today.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Yeah, like, exactly.
I want to start a magazine.
Wait, yeah. Let's start into a dying business. Uh-huh. We had a couple different things that were going on at that point that were kind of parallel paths. One, single malt scotches were really starting to gain a lot of popularity, especially those with age statements. I moved out of Louisville and to half a dozen different places around the country, and you couldn't find, you know, Jim Beam, Wild Turkey, maybe Maker's Mark at the point, but that was about it as far as selection went. And then, as I said, single malts in D.C. and New Orleans, bigger cities that I were in, were very, very popular. And about the same time, my dad and a few of his friends found the opportunity to buy a barrel of Bushmills. And
we went over to Ireland and picked out our barrel. And they, for the millennium, bottled it for us. It was a 25-year-old, 86-proof product, which is a little higher than their average product. And turned out to be an excellent whiskey. And that whetted the appetite to get in the business. It was actually the first distillery I'd ever taken a tour of was in Ireland.
Well, they probably didn't offer tours, much for back really then. Were.
But yeah. they were probably like, wait, you want to see the inside of this place?
It's just a factory. So I want to, about the Bushmills, you know, being 25 years and being in Ireland, I guess with their colder climate, does the 25-year-old Irish whiskey take on as much oak or tannins? You know, it's kind of like bourbons, they're like 25-year-old whiskey here is kind of like, oh, sometimes it's not very good.
Yeah. Well, this was an excellent bourbon, but, you know, their temperature swings are so much less than ours. Yeah. That even though it's in the barrel that long, it really doesn't pick up the flavors that our whiskey does. And, of course, they're used bourbon barrels. So I think the bourbon gets the first cut of that charred barrel and most of the flavors out of it. So even though it's been in that barrel that long, it's an excellent product, but it's not bourbon.
Yeah, we got to stop talking about Bushmills because we're gonna lose a lot of fans. Real quick. Yeah,
dropping off.
Yeah, they're like, and we're done here.
But I think the point at the time, I don't know that anyone else was selling single barrels, and this was just kind of a time value of money proposition for them. You bought it in 1993 and it was going to be ready in the year 2000.
Yeah.
So that really, as far as I know, that was the only thing offered anything like that. And I think that opened our eyes into thinking, you know what, we could, you know, it would seem to reason that we could buy barrels from producers here in Kentucky.
What did a barrel of 25-year-old Bushmills run in 1993? Well, I guess it wasn't 25 years in, but...
It was $5,000.
Okay.
The same barrel sold in Europe was $9,000, the difference taxes.
Okay.
So we felt like it was a bargain. So I found four other fellows who were willing, and we split a barrel. And I've still got some of those bottles available.
Very cool.
They're on the secondary yet?
Yeah.
No.
They're on the Facebook groups.
Part of my children and grandchildren's inheritance.
Hopefully it's worth something. Yeah. Then, right? Yeah.
So you're wanting to go source barrels, you know, are you just approaching distilleries like, hey, what you got? Or, you know, what can we do? Or are they eager to see you? Because, like, we've got this stuff sitting around forever.
I think we were the only ones foolish enough to make the call. They were more than happy to talk to us. They had plenty of whiskey. There were stories back then of people selling off 15, 20-year-old barrels of bourbon, basically to get it off their books and for the price of the wood only. And back then, a used barrel would be about $40. I mean, it was very, very inexpensive barrels at the time.
Wow. Very different.
Yeah. That's
very, very different from today's world.
So I want to rewind a little bit because, Chet, you're also sort of a bourbon historian to a degree as well. I mean, don't get me wrong, like you had a book, you've got a lot of stuff with old labels, and you were kind of a prohibition, pre-prohibition kind of know-it-all too. Kind of talk about your history and lore of bourbon too.
Well, I've always had a fascination with history, and Trey and I worked together 3 or 4 years and turned the business over to him, and then I decided to learn all I could about bourbon, but there hadn't been many books written on the subject. So I started researching, and after about 6 or 7 years, my friends encouraged me to go ahead and put it together in a book, which I did, And I'm now working on my fourth printing of that same book, which is Bourbon in Kentucky. And then I've done a second book called Kentucky Bourbon Barons, which are about the movers and shakers in the bourbon business in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And I go around the state and the country giving talks on the history of bourbon. Of course, I get to taste a lot of Trey's bourbon as we do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, so there's a plus side to it.
Yes.
There's a large upside to it. So, you know, going back to forming the business together as kind of a father and son, you know, Chet, I'll kind of look at you first because it sounded like he was like, all right, we need money to kind of get this thing going, right? Did you look at it like, well, all right, well, I'll help my boy out. We'll kind of see what's going on here. Now, do you really think it was going to be as successful as it is today?
Oh, we had no idea. We had no exit plan. We just thought it was something that would be fun to do together. And it was. We had a great time. Trey did most of the sales, the traveling. I did the stuff inside, the back room kind of things. So we didn't get any.
Did you have the mule? You had the mule kind of figure out exactly what the cherry barrels were?
So, it was a great partnership. And as it turned out, worked out famously.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think our original...
I was about to say, I was like, come on, there had to be one few roadblocks in here. We got to talk about
this.
There
were a lot of roadblocks. We, you know, first of all, our first projections, I think we were way ambitious. it took years to get there. And then, you know, from what's happened in the last, you know, really 10 years, no one could have projected. And you know, just there was... Most of what we do today, if we tried to do that, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, it would have fallen on deaf ears. So there's a bourbon consumer here that just wasn't around 20 years ago. We went to the first bourbon festival, and yeah, I talk about Julian Van Winkle and myself. We had the same deal, buy five cases, get one case, no charge. And between the two of us, we didn't sell a dozen deals. I mean, just there wasn't anyone out there looking for high-end bourbon. So things have really changed. But yeah, there were a lot of obstacles. And there's some obstacles that are present today that weren't there back then. One is the lack of supply that's obvious. But when I started, there were 9 distributors here in Kentucky. And typically in most states, there's really 2 distributors now. So, and of those distributors, most of those guys aren't looking for one SKU brand. It's just not worth their time for the most part. So when there was 9 out in the marketplace, then you could get in with a distributor. If you could go out there and work the market for them, they could take ownership of it eventually and start pushing your product. It's a different proposition now.
So you had mentioned that, you know, it was really hard. You and JVW were sitting there trying to sell your products and basically give some away as just an incentive to be able to do it. You said people weren't purchasing high-end premium spirits at the time, or maybe just high-end premium bourbon. Now, did you kind of see that as like, oh, shit, maybe we're pricing it too high, or should we have tried to go for that old Taylor kind of.
I knew that, you know, a bargain proposition, you know, we would get crushed by the big guys. So that was never an option for us. And then I saw, you know, the proposition, our product versus, say, single malts. I thought we had a better product, and I still think we have a better product. And I think it's more expensive to make a great bourbon than it would be a great scotch. Just the time value of money, the new barrel, you know, the evaporation rate, it's expensive to do it. And I, you know, looked at my dad to the history of it and saw that things came in cycles. And, you know, 2 times in our country's history, bourbon sold more than all other spirits combined. So if we had enough longevity, then somehow it would catch back up. But certainly didn't think it would catch up the way it has today.
And you guys have mentioned scotch a few times. Chet, I'll run this one over to you. What's the next big hurdle, do you think, for bourbon to kind of leapfrog scotch or even come close to the sales of what it's seeing? Because we've already seen that bourbon and rum are kind of increasing in sales in regards of worldwide consumption and stuff like that. However, it's still not near the number of where scotch is.
Well, the folks that made bourbon in its very, very lean years in the 70s and 80s. They kind of shot themselves in the foot to help sales. They cheapened the price and cheapened the image of the product. So it took quite a while to overcome that, to make people realize that it really is a premium product. And as Trey suggests, probably without doubt, the most expensive distilled spirit there is. So people now recognize bourbon for what it is, a superior product. And I think that's gaining more momentum all over the world. And I have little doubt that within the next 10, 20 years, they'll sell more bourbon than they will scotch.
What do you think? Oh, go ahead.
I'm going over to Vietnam in a couple of weeks, and I'm doing something at the embassy, and they're bringing me over there in order to help push the viability of bourbon to Southeast Asia. And I'm going to be visiting, and there's actually a number of
people. Are you going to be on a boat doing it as well? Or?
Well, you never know. Never know. But I think it's a perception problem that, as my dad was saying, it's taken a lot of years to get there, and we haven't had the push overseas that we had domestically. And Diageo has really bulldozed the way in China and a lot of other Asian countries. You know, they bought up a lot of bars and restaurants and nightclubs that they own, and so they are pushing what they have, which is mainly scotch. So Johnny Walker has been the lead dog out there. But I think there's opportunity bourbon being a corn-based product is an easier product because most people have grown up drinking corn starch soft drinks, Coke, things like that. It's an easier transition.
Just because of the sweetness or the nature of it?
Yeah. And I think that it's just a matter of getting, right now in those countries, if it doesn't say scotch, it's not going to sell. It's a perception that people just need to get over. So, will it take time? Yes. But can it happen? Absolutely.
I guess with that, though, the like everyday drinkers, the people that I guess, what bourbon was built for, the everyday, they're kind of like, well, we're getting kind of squeezed out of this because everybody's focused on premium. You see Heaven Hill cutting like the 6-year, white label. Right. So like we're kind of like, well, we're getting priced out of, where we want to be too.
Well, as I say, I think there's still, especially what's going on with production lately, we're in a tight spot right now. As you guys were talking about earlier, sourcing product, there's certainly a shortage today. If you look at the production and how much the category is growing, there is going to be a point where there's going to be a glut again. And who knows exactly where that access point comes. But I think there's always going to be that premium and allocated items that are going to be, tried to be stretched across what's going to be a worldwide market at some point. But there's going to be value products for the long term.
And so I kind of want your take on that as well, because or at least within the kind of the previous conversation about our brands, do you think underselling themselves on the value of their product? Because, there's different price points that people want to hit, and you're trying to come to a premium category. And we talked about the old Crows and the old Taylors you kind of see down here and the, some of the ones in the plastic jugs. Now, do you think a lot of those are underselling themselves? Or do you still think that's just the nature of the market and those still have to exist?
I think a lot of that's, they're underselling themselves. I think they can go up a little bit, but there's always going to be that market down there because there are big producers out there that are going to guarantee that those markets are out there. And, I think that's fantastic. And, everything is an evolution. And, as I say, very few people start drinking bourbon neat right off the bat, As my dad said, he started like most of us here, which is different than a lot of people now. I think everybody in this room, probably their first bourbon was a bourbon and Coke or bourbon and Seven.
I'm a bourbon and ginger man.
Bourbon and ginger, there you go. I was in Brooklyn recently and ordered a Jefferson's Ocean on the rocks and they wouldn't serve it to me. No, you can't have it with the rocks. You've got to drink that neat. And I'm like, okay, can I have a neat glass of ocean
with ice on
with
top?
An ice? Okay.
You're like, I make this stuff. I can do it the whole
world. Oh, I'm sure he probably didn't want to go in like that, right? He probably
didn't say anything. But, you know, so there are a lot of people now that are coming to bourbon from the get-go thinking you drink
straight out the gate, yeah.
Which is, you know, that's kind of a tough pill to swallow. It's kind of like doing a double flip off a high dive first time in the pool. So most people don't come in drinking neat bourbon, nor do they come into the high end of the range right away. It's a graduation, and it should be a graduation. You know, you shouldn't be paying up for certain products until your palate has gotten to a certain point.
Right.
But do you think today's, I guess the new guys in bourbon, we see them online, but they all went to just the expensive bottle. They never really like go for the medium price, or they're just like so focused on limited releases. And why isn't that a mistake though?
There's
all they want's Twin Oak. That's all they're looking for is Twin Oak.
Right now, there's any of the big producers in Kentucky are making a great product, and yeah, they're aging it long enough. They know they've got distilling down to a T. They're making great products. So, you know, there's value out there. Now, there's different nuances and there's certain characteristics that you either want to get rid of or you want to enhance. Then there's certainly, you know, plenty of options out there now that weren't out there when we started.
Mm-hmm. So I kind of want to bring it back a little bit to your whiskey as well. And Chet, I'll kind of spin this over to you. Because when you guys were coming out with this particular brand, you know, we had talked about, you had just mentioned, you know, whether they're coming at a high proof, they're coming at low proof, they're figuring out what they're going to mix it with. What was the flavor profile or the type of consumer that you were targeting when you were coming out with your initial launch?
Well, because we were so small, we had to find a niche that made sense for us. And that was the high-end market. That market was small back then, but so were we. So you could buy a really nice bottle of whiskey back then, a fifth of whiskey for $25. We introduced a 15-year-old product at $50 a fifth, which was outlandish, but it worked. You know, there's always that segment of the market that is willing to step up and pay a little more for a quality product. So we worked very hard on the name, on the bottle, the package, to make it what it is. If you don't pick the bottle off the shelf, you can't find out what's inside. So we knew what they'd like the whiskey. It was a very rich, full-bodied whiskey. We just needed to get people to pick the bottle up.
So how did you convince them to do that, to make that leap with you?
Well, we didn't have a marketing budget, that's for sure.
We got exceeding.
Besides doing the buy four cases, give one free.
that was our that was our deal at Whiskey Fest.
Yeah.
Whiskey Fest only.
We tried to come up with a name that was associated with high quality Jefferson's. We wanted to help create a renaissance in the bourbon business. What better man than Jefferson's, a renaissance man? We used...
That was our first slogan, wasn't it?
It was.
What was the slogan?
The Renaissance bourbon.
Yeah, it was perhaps.
The bourbon renaissance for a man or a woman, something.
I've forgotten. But we actually went out and found a perfume bottle and used it for the style and shape of our bottle and just blew it up into fist size, because we discovered a lot of women were buying the high-end products.
Mm-hmm.
So we got lucky again. It worked.
What research went into that to figure out that you found out women were fine?
Oh, we had lots of research sitting over the kitchen table drinking bourbon and saying, yeah, I think they're going to like this.
We
saw something that said that more women are purchasing the product. Maybe the men dictated what to purchase, but they were actually the one buying it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm assuming, were you only selling in Kentucky at a certain time?
We started off with what was Commonwealth Distributors. That is actually, it was the Vertner Smith distributorship at the time, which has been bought out and bought out and bought out, and now is Republic National. And then I think my first sales trip, I went to the WSWA in San Francisco, couldn't afford even a booth on the floor, or not to mention a suite. So I literally, my mom loves this story. I rode the elevator and escalators up and down with a briefcase and looking at name tags, and anybody that I saw was a distributor, I had my bottle in their face.
So how difficult is it to make
straight
that leap?
Hustle right,
yeah,
there,
that's
though.
All right. To get in, for, you know, you start in Kentucky, but to get to other states, talk about the challenges to...
It was really difficult. Again, there was no market for high-end bourbon. So my second market, luckily I met somebody at that WSWA, the Wine and Spirits Wholesalers Association, distributor in Nashville. And he said, all right, we sell some bourbon down here, and we'll give you a shot. So basically I would go down there Monday through Thursday for the first couple of months that we got into that market, and just, you know, selling bottles one at a time. And he picked up the phone, called somebody in Georgia and say, hey, I've got somebody down here. He'll go out there and hustle for you. He's got a great product. Take a look at it. And I actually, when we got that distributor, that was National Distributing Company. And at the time they probably had 7 or 8 states. And I thought, and he said, okay, I'm going to take you into all of them. I thought we hit gold. I thought we were done.
Are you like, yes, but oh shit, we got to come up with a bunch of juice now?
No, no, the juice wasn't a problem. So that wasn't the issue. It was, yes, all right. But you know, you have to understand these guys were bringing it in, and you can grow, you know, from a physical standpoint, geography wise, too quickly, too fast. Mm-hmm. I couldn't support, you know, it was just me going out there. So I couldn't support those other states, and you know, I couldn't spend Monday through Thursday in each market, each, you know. So it that wasn't the promised land that we thought it would be. So it was a slow grind.
Yeah. I also kind of want to rewind to when you guys were starting to start blending your first mm-hmm. barrels together. Who kind of took the lead, and who figured like this is going to be the winner? Like, how can we replicate this over and over? Kind of talk about that process.
Well, we started, we bought a couple lines. The first one we found, Jefferson's Reserve, we fell in love with right away. We kind of both looked at each other and said, that's it. That's the one that we've been looking for.
Now, were you all the ones blending it, or do you have some outside help that were?
We were just buying at this point. And so it wasn't a blend. It was one recipe, one age. That was it. Mm-hmm. We decided what proof to cut it, and that was all we did with it.
If you want to spill more, I'm sure listeners would love to hear, you know, who you're sourcing it from, the recipe, the mash bill. You know,
unfortunately, I'd be proud to beat my chest and tell you who it was, because they're great producers.
Chet's legal side will come out and say,
it's our suppliers that have historically said in our contract, we can't disclose who it is. So we haven't done that. But we found another one that we really liked. And as we named the first one after Thomas Jefferson, because we thought it was complex and sophisticated like Thomas Jefferson, we found one that was spicy and big and bold, and named that Sam Houston. Came out with another one, Old Iron Skillet. We came out with Jefferson's.
Old Iron Skillet. Just tell me, lead me through the thought process of this one. Is this another, you were sitting around the kitchen and you're like, where's an Old Iron Skillet?
My dad, there was a restaurant by the name of Old Iron Skillet. And they wanted a proprietary brand.
How long have you been drinking today?
You've been pounding those LaCroix.
We bottled up a batch, and it sold very, very well. Yeah. I'm delighted to say.
Was that a revitalization of a label they had, or was it just they just said, like, we just want a name?
A friend of his from college owned the restaurant, right?
Right. Bowling Green.
Mm-hmm. Very cool.
So, yeah. So I started, you know, as we started collecting these different recipes and barrels, we, you know, started, well, I can't come out with a different label each time we find something we like. And we started playing around with them and found that the whole was better than the parts. And So we made the decision, let's go ahead and start blending. And we thought it was terrifying. We may lose all of our customers, all six of them.
At that time, were you blending form, or were they just like single barrels? And you're like, I'll just give you 150 bottles or whatever the hell's in the barrel.
It was about 8 to 12 barrels.
Okay.
At the time. So, yeah.
Just dumping and hope for the best? Is that?
No, we would, you know, scientifically break it down. Yeah, some way we had it measured out pretty well.
Beaker here, beaker there.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we did. And so, you know, that became fun because we were creating our own. And it's, you know, our first real step into doing something a little bit different or something a little bit unique for us. At the time, nobody was blending, or if they were, they certainly weren't talking about it.
Bourbon Pursuit wouldn't be possible without the support of our Patreon community and with help of our following partners. Now, I've never been inside a prison before, but that's exactly what the folks at Rackhouse Whiskey Club did when they recently took a trip to North Carolina. Behind cell blocks east and west, they found barrels of bourbon being aged, and it's entirely legal. Rackhouse Whiskey Club stumbled upon Whiskey Prison. It's the home to Southern Grace Distilleries at Mount Pleasant Prison. The prison opened in 1929 during the height of Prohibition, and as many as 140 prisoners called it home until it closed in 2011. In 2016, a new operation moved in, and this secure facility houses more than 14,000 gallons of aging whiskey. Conviction Small Batch Bourbon is the first bourbon ever to be legally aged behind bars. It's the prison you'd probably want to break into. Rackhouse Whiskey Club is a Whiskey of the Month club, and they're on a mission to uncover the best flavors and stories that craft distilleries across the U.S. have to offer. Rackhouse ships out two of the featured distillery's finest bottles, along with some cool merchandise, in a box to your door every 2 months. Go to rackhousewhiskeyclub.com to check it out and try a bottle of Conviction today. Use code PURSUIT for $25 off your first box.
I want some tips on blending because Kenny and I, we're trying to...
We're getting there.
We're getting there, but every time we try to do a blend, like single barrels is easy, you know, mm-hmm. go pick those. I think that, yeah, you know...
You like it?
If you like it, it's great. Let's bottle it. But doing that blend and making it taste good, I don't know. Help me.
Trial and error.
Help me.
Trial and error. You know, you get a few ideas of what profile you're looking for and think, okay, what would help me get to that profile? And... then, you know, it's just trial and error. And then once you hone it down, it gets easier and easier because you have a good idea what your base is going to be. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, for our Jefferson's Reserve, we've got four different recipes in there. One of it, our base comprises about 65%. The other three can kind of float, but you know what percentages and what age, and have a good idea what'll get you there.
Okay. So like when you're blending, say you have like, you know, there's a range, I'm sure, of years and barrels, and you said it was 65%. So, like, I guess we were talking about this the other day. When you go and you tap into a 6-year barrel, and you're like, it's just not there. But will it be there in like 3 to 4 years, or will it just continue to, you know?
You're about to say suck, didn't
suck.
You?
Luckily, you can blend off the ones.
Or
that
can
do.
You tell at that 6-year that it's going to progress to 9 to 10? That the way we think it will. And we're going to leave it alone.
You start getting at that point where you can figure out how it's going to go. But, you know, it takes years because you got to just wait and anticipate and kind of mark it down what you think's going to happen to it in the future and check and see if it does.
Okay. Cool. I want to also talk to you about all the, I guess, relationships and you talked about suppliers and whatnot. There's a lot that, because there's a stigma around sourced whiskey that, oh, they're just buying barrels, dumping it. Like, talk about all the moving parts, I guess, of sourcing, because you have packaging and bottlers and all this and all that to make it, you know, happen, if you can talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's bottling and packaging and all that. That's just sourcing your dry goods. That's the easy part once you've figured it out.
Mm-hmm.
And then sourcing, it's, you know, we've had 20-year relationships. So, as we talked about, we'll lay down 8,000 barrels of new fill this year. We'll do about 2,300 out at our distillery, Kentucky Artisan Distillery. The rest is from big distillers here in Kentucky that have been making our recipe. So, you know, that's, you know, if I had to go to them today and negotiate that, my price wouldn't be where it is today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've got a great distillery, and we do, it actually, we just won award for the best craft distillery today. And really proud with what's going on out there. You know, we're growing our grains at the farm that butts up to the distillery. We've got some historic stills. We've got the only malting house. We've got some really fun and cool things. But, you know, I just saw Chuck Algery say something with all the changes of the distillers going on right now. You know, somebody asked the question, what's going to change with the whiskey now that these distillers have changed? And his answer was, most of these guys would tell you, hopefully not a damn thing.
Right.
Because their job is to make it consistent and sell.
Mm-hmm.
And
plus the team that's underneath of them.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
And all the systems and processes in place.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the goal of a distillery, is to make the same product over and over and over. So when we source from a big distillery like that, we'll get that consistency. They can make that more consistent than we can at ours, because it's just one economies of scale and they're running the same thing over and over and over. So, you know, if you look at, so I just came from Scotland and went to about 8 different distilleries there. Everybody, the whiskey maker in Scotland is a guy who blends the barrels together. The distiller is the production manager. So to me, if I can get great source product, it's definitely just as satisfying to me as what we're making ourselves, because it's what we take that source product and do with it afterwards. That's what's interesting to me, and that's where I think we can do something a little bit different. I told somebody not too long ago, you know, what would I try to do by getting into distilling myself? I'm never going to out Jimmy Russell, Jimmy Russell.
Right.
You know, that's... Yeah, you know, there's generations of knowledge in there, and you know, technique, and how many distilleries have you identified in Kentucky alone?
About 2,400.
When we started, there were 8 left in Kentucky.
That's right.
And as I said earlier, they all make incredible juice.
Mm-hmm.
It's what happens to it, and this is what made me interested in getting into the maturation of it. Every distiller would say the same thing. 75% of what bourbon is comes from the maturation process. It's once it hits the wood that really starts to turn from whiskey into bourbon. That's when you can manipulate it one way or the other.
So I think there, with source whiskey too, there's, I don't know, there's kind of like a contradiction, because these distilleries that are sourcing the product are saying, well, we make our own stuff. You know, we're pounding our chest, but they're happy to sell it though to, you know, people that want to source whiskey. So it's like, are they the ones causing this, you know, bad drama or bad stigma with source whiskey, or where do you think that comes from?
Well, I think most of them have sourced whiskey themselves from somebody else at some point in time.
Mm-hmm.
If not yesterday.
Nobody's guilty, or nobody's innocent in this whole game.
Right.
Right. And you know, that's a selling point for them. You know, they can control it, you know, vertically from point A all the way to Z. So yeah, I think there is a selling point in that, and there's something to be said for that. And I don't think, you know, you look in wines and other spirits, people source for other people all the time. Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah. Like Tylenol, my emergency thing. I poured an emergency pack the other day, and that was the generic brand, and it actually said package for same company that does emergency. And I was like, you know, yeah, it's in every industry, you know, but sure. For some reason in bourbon though, it's like people go kind of crazy about it. And it,
you know, it's,
cause like you said, distilling is an exact, you know, you're making a consistent product, but when you're blending and making your own, that's where the magic is, you know, and picking your own barrels.
And that's all Trey. Trey is the blender. I never had any part of that. I will say I did have a part in going around with him to the various sources and finding our whiskey. And you learn pretty quick which sources worked for our brand. Mm-hmm. So it didn't take long. You know, you have all these choices available, but it didn't take long to figure out what worked mm-hmm. well together.
So another question from the business side, are you ending up in sort of like maybe a turf war nowadays where if you're sourcing from a particular distillery and all of a sudden somebody comes in and they're waving their checkbook around and you're like, well, hey guys, we've been doing business for 15, 20 years. And those are my barrels.
And it's not us. We don't have a checkbook. Our checkbook is very small.
They're trying to squeeze you for a few more dollars out of these barrels. Now, do you end up with those turf wars at any point? I see Chet's eye. He's like, oh, fuck yeah.
You know, we've been lucky that we've been able to source the way we have been for so long. But, you know, we just completed our third warehouse that's going to hold 13,000 barrels. We've already laid the foundation for a fourth. So we're laying down a lot of whiskey right now.
That's fantastic.
So, you know, it's something we've got. We just bought an additional 14 acres to our property, and we are contemplating whether to build out to where we would be able to produce 100% of what we needed. And that comes, you know, there's a lot of things to weigh there. One, you've got the initial capital cost.
Pros, cons.
Yeah,
cost-benefit analysis.
You got it. But it goes further than just cost benefits. You know, it's nice to have different suppliers, you know, in case something happens. And as we talked about it earlier, it's more expensive for us to make our bourbon ourselves than it is to source from someone else currently. Now, as we've expanded and we've just ordered 6 more fermenters out there, so we'll be able to expand more, we've been able to bring our cost way down. But it's still, there's, you know, it's mm-hmm. economies of scale.
Absolutely.
So, you know, it's something that, you know, it's something that we're taking a really strong look at, but it's not the end all be all for me right now.
So I kind of want to move past this conversation a little bit and kind of talk about your pet sharks.
Yeah.
And Chet, I'm going to toss this one over to you. You know, when Trey came with you and he says, like, I got this idea, and this what kind of spurred off for Jefferson's Ocean, which anybody that wants to know more about it, please go listen to the past episode. He kind of talked about Juan Share and all this other kind of fun mm-hmm. stuff on there. What did you think of it? Were you just like, Jesus Christ, Trey, come on, this is a gimmick? Or were you like, this is a fantastic idea? What did you think?
I thought it was an excellent idea, and it turned out it was. Mm-hmm. That barrel does so many things that people just don't keep in mind. It's not only breathing out, it's breathing in. So that salt air came right through that barrel. And when he brought that first bottle home, I just, it was the best thing I ever tasted. It was almost black in color and just heavenly. It was wonderful. So, and he's always coming up with ideas like that. So,
What's your favorite of his ideas?
Oh, man.
Put you on the spot.
There's been so many. You know, I like the product that's finished in the Groth Cabernet mm-hmm. Cast. His Twin Oaks product is excellent. Of course, we all remember the 17 and 18-year-old stuff that he had for a while. Unfortunately, didn't have enough of it. But
story of everybody's life, I think.
Yeah. But he has just come out with some terrific products.
Well, let's talk about the Twin Oak, because you poured that for us. And
this is actually our double barrel. So I've got the Twin Oak as well. Difference between those two, the Twin Oak was a 16-year-old that we double barreled for I should say Twin Oaked it, because we Twin Oaked it for 5 years. So we put it into a new barrel when it was 11 years old and kept it in there, which I would have never have guessed we would have kept it in there for that long. But I thought it kept improving along the way. And
did you just forget about it? You're like, oh, shit, I got this thing that's been sitting around for 5 years.
Oh, yeah, I forgot this other project.
No, that's the best thing about it. You get to go back and taste all these experiments.
Been too focused on oceans. I forgot about that.
But I think it came out great, and I'll pour some of this for you in just a second. But one of the things, because it was a heavier char on there, I think it cleaned it up as well. So it imparted a lot of flavor, but it doesn't taste tanniny like you would think it would. Mm-hmm.
Now, were you taking Jefferson's Reserve that was 11 years old and then putting in here, or are these just extra barrels? Okay.
That's exactly what it was.
And was it already blended as Jefferson Reserve then you put in the barrels, or was it kind of like, well, we'll just take barrels and keep dumping and we'll figure this out?
Well, I should say it was the base bourbon for Jefferson's Reserve. So it would have been what we originally sourced that same recipe in barrels.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
And then on the Double Oak, which we did a proprietary barrel, we took 10-year-old bourbon, and I've been working with Independent Stave Company. I became a barrel chef for them in 2012 on their 100th year anniversary. And I was down at their cooperage in Missouri, not the one in Kentucky, and became a barrel chef. I saw all the different techniques that they were putting into wine barrels and different spirit barrels from around the world. I think they've got somewhere close to a dozen cooperages around the world. And when I thought about all the techniques that they've developed over the years and all the expertise that had gone into those techniques, I thought, well, why are we only doing it this one rudimentary way as we are here in Kentucky?
Number 4, alligator char everywhere.
You got it. You got it. So why not try to incorporate some of the things that they've developed in other spirits and wines and bring it into the bourbon world? So I took some bourbon that was distilled and aged in Kentucky and aged in a number 3 char barrel. And I put it into a barrel we did probably 5-6 dozen different experiments to hone in. Got one that had been seasoned and flash charred and toasted to bring out a mocha flavor, and then grooved out so you have twice as much surface area on it. And double barreled it for an additional 4 months. And that's what you were just drinking. It brings out a lot of flavor there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mine's gone. It was very good.
Oh, it goes fast, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So another question for you, as while you are looking at bringing in your own distillate into this, and plus your aged source product, at some point, are you going to try to follow along the path that Smooth Ambler's done with, say, Contradiction, and start blending some of your distillate with the source stuff? Or do you think that there's opportunity for brand and line extension at that point?
A little bit of both. So what we're distilling over at Kentucky Artisan Distillery is it's a higher concentration of rye. It's a 36 rye. It's also put in the barrel at 110 proof. And we use toasted barrels. And so it's going to be what I call our blending bourbon that's coming of age. So a little bit of that goes a long way. But I think there's certainly going to be a market for it to come out with its own product. Some of the rye, we are, as a matter of fact,
we've got
some rye right here that is
awesome.
We won't say
been
no to
finished
that.
In a couple different things that
got a guest bedroom here.
Yeah, we'll start. We need to bring out the dartboard and be like, all right, what do we think this is aged in?
So that's 115 proof that you're tasting right there.
Yummy.
It's interesting you at the finish, because you've had the Jefferson's rye at one point in history, and then that sort of was it just depleted stocks at that point? You just couldn't keep up with it.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. And so now you're starting to bring it back out to the market, but in a kind of a tray fashion, if you will.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we've come out, I think, with 18 different products. Beside 16 of those 18, we do more than what most people do, which is distill, age cut to proof in bottle. Mm-hmm. So our 10-year-old rye, I didn't do a thing with that. And some of our presidential, I just bottle and cut to proof. Mm-hmm.
All right, it's time to guess. What do you think this was barreled in? Because you kind of think it might be an old rum barrel, but I'm thinking that he doesn't want to do the same thing that Angel's Envy did. I don't know. What do you think, Ryan? That or...
It's not a rum barrel.
Let's see. Here's another. We'll figure this out. How big is the barrel? How many gallons?
We'll leave that one alone for a little bit. So that's something that we're working on right now.
It's fun. I like it.
It's interesting. It's really cool.
Yeah. Excellent product. Mm-hmm.
And those two are a little bit different.
We're not drinking the same thing?
No, but they're close.
Well, here, pass it over.
You think I didn't drink
it? Yeah, though. I was like, mine doesn't taste like rum. But I was like, maybe I'm off today. I don't know.
Yeah, who knows?
All right, I'm going to pour you one last one. This is the 16-year-old Twinwood.
This one, I remember last time we had talked.
I can see where you think the rum in this.
Maybe. Mm-hmm. Last time we had talked on the podcast, we had actually talked and we said, is there ever going to be another Jefferson's Presidential release? Mm-hmm. And you said, I think so.
Wait for it.
Wait for it, right? And I think this might have been the one that finally came out that we were talking about.
Could have been.
Mm-hmm.
Probably.
It was so long ago.
Yeah, I know. We got to do this more often.
Exactly. I don't remember when you were
here. Wednesdays with Trey. And Chet.
Well, I'm delighted to say, as we've gone around to our sources, almost 100%, I can say, that we agree on the whiskey we choose, which is kind of amazing. I don't know if that's a father-son kind of thing, but we've been very fortunate in not having any difficulty.
You inherited the same palate?
Yes.
You
know.
I guess. I've been stealing his whiskey for so long.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, you were drinking Old Fitz growing up. You know?
Exactly. Strolls and Old Fitz. That was a combination. But yeah, and that has been a lot of the fun. It's been so much fun to be able to do this together. And have that common bond, and just to do this today together. And it's a lot of, most father sons don't get the opportunity to do that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It is a family affair. And I think that's kind of what we wanted to capture today was, you know, really looking at what you all did together to help build the brand in the early days and some of the struggles that you went through and everything like that. Now, we are reaching up to the top of the hour here, but I want to talk about this 16-year Twin Oak. So kind of give us a little bit of background, because I know this is already come and gone,
at least most of the area.
Fantastic.
Right. I wanted to get your old take on it. I did hear one of your podcasts where you brought it up and you didn't have a chance to taste it. So I wanted you all to taste it and see what you thought.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity. This is great.
Day.
Now we got to make sure we watch what we say, because everybody's listening. Everybody's listening.
He travels a lot, so you know he's got time to listen to us.
It's great. It's a lot of depth of flavors in there. I mean, I think also being 16 year, you definitely get some
really
of those deep, dark oak and kind of the pieces that really come into it. The leather, the caramels.
A lot of the leather comes out. And as I said, this surprised me. I had no intentions of leaving that in there, double boak, or twin wood, as we call it, for 5 years. And it's clean. It's still very flavorful, but cleaner than I would have guessed.
Now, do you have potentially more of these that'll make its way to the market? Like, you got more sitting in these one of these three rick houses you've got?
We've got some interesting things there.
Yeah.
We've got some nice things coming out. So I'm excited about our pipeline.
Mm-hmm. So when's the next trip down the NOLA? Because I know that was an experiment that you had tried
as
well.
That was when we were just talking about it. That was just taking off, I think.
You bet. So we're about to release those. I think we're going to go ahead and start selling the Journey at the gift shop in Crestwood 1st of November. So it came out great. You know, that's a very small volume. We actually had two more barrels that did the great loop, which we just got back, and I'll show it to you. It's right in there. You can't imagine the color on a year-old product that looks as dark as a 15-year-old product.
Really?
So it's indicative.
But does it taste like a 15-year-old product?
It tastes extremely easy and smooth. You still get a little grassiness or a little grain up front. So, but there's no question, as we bottled the Journey and we kind of co-pack it together with another, with a barrel that was distilled on the same day and aged in Kentucky, in my mind,
night and day.
Yeah. Totally night and day. And it explains why bourbon really proliferated in Kentucky, because people who were tasting this product, the distillers had no idea how good it could have been, because this is what changed whiskey to bourbon for the first time, that journey that it took. And by the time it got to the East Coast, it transformed into a completely different product that was so much far superior than the one that aged in Kentucky. You know, that's why people paid so much more for the bourbon coming from Kentucky.
Mm-hmm. And they still do now.
I think he sounds like he has to buy a bigger boat to go down to New Orleans more often. I think that's probably what it is.
So that journey actually, it started off, the first leg of the journey went to New Orleans. Then we got it down to Key West eventually, up to Fort Lauderdale, lost our boat during Hurricane Matthew, had a hitchhike up to New York, and it took four boats. We had two hurricanes, a tropical storm. We had to send new barrels down to Key West and siphon the juice out of the old barrels into the new barrels because the barrel heads had warped and popped.
That's one hell of a story.
Yeah, I was about to say, I was like,
that whiskey's like, let me tell you what I've been through.
And actually, Popular Mechanics did a great story breaking it down molecularly and showing the difference between the what happened on the bourbon that went on the journey versus the one that stayed here in Kentucky.
Very cool.
So when it actually went on the journey, you had to bring it back. You're like, all right, fuck it. We're putting it on the truck and sending it back. Like, we're not gonna do this.
Well, by that time, yes. However, the same guy that we hitchhiked with took the barrel. It took two more barrels around for us, and again, it came out wonderful.
So, you tell me about the hitchhike. Like, you weren't like, where you literally had your fingers out, like you're on the river.
Yeah, like, or did you make a phone call? Kind of talk about
we're going.
This.
Well, we made a few phone calls. And I found that there's a group called the Great Loopers that take a loop going up the East Coast, up the Hudson River into the Great Lakes and down into Kentucky through the Tom Bigbee Waterway, back into Mobile Bay and down to Florida and back around. And there's a group of people that do this throughout the year. And there was someone that was curious enough when we put out the SOS, can you help us out, to say, this sounds like fun.
We'll be there in 3 days.
So we were a little worried. Well,
they're probably like, there's at least a few bottles in it for me, right?
Yeah. I tried to give him as much finished goods as possible so he wouldn't touch the stuff in the barrel.
Yeah, smart move. Smart move. So I think that'll be good to kind of wrap this up. You know, this was fun. I think we could probably talk about this for another hour if we really wanted to, because, you know, really, as I said earlier, capturing the story of you two starting the brand, understanding what it went in to actually build it, I think it's fascinating. It is always fun, and it's always awesome to be able to come here and try some of these innovations that you're doing. There's a lot of people, it doesn't matter who we talk to, but there's a common theme that come up, and they always like, we're innovating. We just released our first sherry cask, and we're like, all right, fuck it. Like, that's been done. Right. Yeah, that's been done. But you're truly thinking like way outside of this particular box that most people are.
Yeah.
You know, it's fun. Once you peel back a layer of the onion, you see, okay, if that worked, why couldn't this work? And you can keep pushing in that direction. And that's what's fun for me. To see, you know, we've got a number of experiments going. Some of them don't turn out. Some of them do. And, you know, you get to keep tasting them. So
I have a canoe trip that I do every year in the Ozarks. If you want to hook me up,
you got it.
Called the Jack's Fork Special.
I don't know if the TTB would let us on that one.
Yeah. Can you fit a 53-gallon barrel in that canoe?
Yeah, you're probably right. We'll be floating real low, riding low in that.
Absolutely. So, you know, Trey and Chet, thank you so much for coming on the show today. It was a pleasure to have you all. If you want to know more about Jefferson's, make sure you go follow all of their social media online. They've got a great website too. I remember you used to be able to go and you could track the journey that some of these things were going on as well. Is that still going on?
Well, we don't have that journey going on right now. You can track the ocean voyages, and we just
caught. Talk about your shark. We totally forgot about your pet sharks.
Yeah,
about the pet shark real quick.
After 2 years, O-Search, which is the friend of mine, Chris Fisher, who's our mayor's brother from here in Louisville, who's the expedition leader of O-Search, who's trying to save the world's ocean from the top predator down, for the last 2 years has been trying to catch a mature male great white shark. He just caught seven of them in Nova Scotia and named one of them Jefferson's. So it's a 12-pound, 7-inch great white that will be tracked as it every time the fin comes up, it pings, sends information back. And what happens, there are scientists from around the world. He basically lays out the information, gives it to any university, marina, aquarium, to hopefully trying to find the answers to the world's ocean and make sure our grandkids have fish sandwiches.
Got a lot of Catholics around here. So yeah, gotta feed on Fridays.
Say, drink bourbon and do good for the ocean.
That's right.
How'd you get hooked up with that and going through the research part of it?
So Chris is a childhood friend of mine. He invited me down on a ship in Costa Rica for our 40th birthday. And while we were on the ship, we drank a lot of bourbon and I saw it sloshing around in a bottle. And I thought, this would happen in a barrel. It's going to change the maturation process. Hey, Chris, let's put some barrels on your ship. Mm-hmm. He's like, well, my crew catches great white sharks. Probably not a good idea. But
we'll only put four of them. We'll start with four.
Basically what happened.
Uh-huh. And there was also, I remember, a giveaway at some point where you were looking at like allowing somebody from, I think it was like a liquor barn giveaway, to have
He was going to join us on the Nova Scotia expedition, but couldn't make it. And we'll be doing another one as well. So
I'll wait for the phone call.
Wait for it. It's coming. And the experience on the ship is incredible.
It looks like it's really fun. That was one thing. If Fred couldn't be here today, and he said that you had the opportunity to, you know, he said, we'll take Fred and we'll go feed him to the sharks.
Yeah, we'll just chum with Fred.
Yeah.
I love ascots. Sharks.
He was saying, yeah, we'll go swim with sharks, but Fred, you're not going in the cage, buddy. You actually have to go swim.
You.
Again, guys, I want to say thank you again for coming on the show.
Thanks
fantastic.
A lot for coming out.
Thanks for the booze. For being it was here. Fantastic.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, make sure you follow everything that Trey is doing with Jefferson's on social media. And make sure you follow us as well, Bourbon Pursuit, on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And if you like the show, make sure you all support us, patreon.com/bourbonpursuit.
Yep. And we love show suggestions, feedback, comments from all our listeners.
And reviews.
And reviews are important because we got the most reviews of any bourbon podcast, but we like to still keep
even
them
more,
coming.
Even more.
We like to have our egos petted. So. No, I'm kidding. But anyways, I really appreciate you all taking the time to hang out with us, and we'll see you next time.
Sounds great. Thanks a lot. Mm-hmm.